offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, coming to you live from our studios at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center. And it is my pleasure, privilege and honor to be with you week after week in the pretext of going through this beautiful work, which is the Bhagavad Gita. And it gives me immense fulfillment to do this week after week with all of you. And as I have mentioned it so many times, the primary beneficiary of this is me, and the company that you all are giving me is only enabling me to study and go deeper into Swami's message. And if in the process, by listening to this, you all are able to benefit, I most gratefully offer that at Swami's lotus feet as a blessing that he's giving me. We went through a very, very important verse in the last couple of weeks, verse number 22 of the 9th chapter. The verse that begins as Ananyas Chintayanto Mam Yejanaha Pariyupasate. Swami had said that it's the most important shloka of the entire Gita. He called it the crest jewel. He called it the one shloka that if you understand and more importantly practice, you would have understood and practiced the entire Bhagavad Gita. That's how much importance and emphasis Swami gave to that one shloka. So we gave it as much time as we could probably give. And even that is not complete. It doesn't comprehensively cover what that shloka stands for. But we did make a humble effort to look into it and look at the various other discourses and writings where Swami has alluded to this shloka and given the various interpretations to it. So we went through few more interpretations last week, few we covered in the week before that, for especially the words Ananya Chintana and Yoga Kshema, and what Krishna meant when he said Yoga Kshemam Vahamyaham. I will carry the responsibility of Yoga Kshema. The whole idea being that through faith and love, one reaches that state where everything is seen as God. Right? Not seeing the world as being another, being different or being separate from God is the ultimate state, which is referred to as Ananya Chintana or Ananyas Chintayanta. And to get there, to reach that state, one goes through this process of love and surrender to God, who becomes the center or becomes the fulcrum of one's life. Of course, in the context, we also discussed how precious it is if one has come to a state in one's journey across many lifetimes to a point where one feels a sense of love for God, who has this devotion springing forth from the heart, and how that should not be looked at as something lesser or not very critical. In the approach of trying to glorify the goal of life, which is to understand that your real self is divine, to understand the unity between the Atma and the Brahman, what we refer to as Advaita, we generally tend to underplay the importance of bhakti or devotion. Yes, bhakti, when it is in its pure emotional form, is immature. It is a sign of ignorance also, one can say. But that doesn't take away the importance of the role that bhakti plays in this journey towards oneness, right? That's why this shloka is very important, and that's why we spent a lot of time on that. After we had completed that, we went through shlokas 23 and 24, which brought us back to the context of the shloka. 22 is placed in the Gita. Krishna said in the 23rd verse of the 9th chapter that those who happen to worship other gods, Anya Devataha, the contrast to Ananya Chintana is this word that he uses as those who worship Anya Devataha. If their worship is sincere, if it is one driven by faith, even that worship reaches the same Lord. Right? So that's what Krishna says in the 23rd. He goes on to say, Te api mam eva kaunteya yajanti avidhi purvakam. they too worship me alone, but by the wrong method, avidhi, the method or the approach is wrong. What is Krishna referring to is, what is Krishna referring to as being improper or being avidhi? As we had seen in the 7th chapter, all those who are called worshippers of other deities are in reality those that have specific desires, right? God is one. God is not many. God is only one, and that's always the truth. But when we approach Him with different desires and with different ambitions and aspirations, to us, the worshipper, God becomes a devata, a specific deity who is answering a specific prayer, right? So the right vidhi is to trust God's plan, right? If I go to God in front of prayer, in front of God in the form of a desire, carrying a prayer, then I am worshipping a deity. If I have the ability to trust God and have faith in God's master plan, then it is the right vidhi, right? That's one conclusion we can come to based on that shloka. And in the next shloka, he says, what is the problem with this? Why is this an improper way of approaching God? And what is the problem with that? He says, aham hi sarvajnanam, sarva yajnanam, bhokta cha prabhureva cha. I am the bhokta, the final receiver of all yajnas, and also the super lord. Natu mam abhijananti tatvena ataha chavanti te. But they do not know me in truth, tatvena, and hence ataha chavanti te. They fall back or sink. Right, so that is what he says. Why is it not? Why is it improper? Why is it not the right method of approaching God? Why is not the right form of worship? Because this form of worship does not fulfill the purpose of attaining that immortality. It only brings you back again and again to what we refer to as the mrityuloka or the karma loka, where you again have to come, perform karma, face its consequences, so on and so forth. So how does this happen? When he says that you fall down, you sink back, how is this brought about? Krishna is going to reiterate that in the next shloka. Again, what he says here is not something that we have not come across before in the Gita. And what I'm going to give in explanation for the shloka is also not something that you might not have heard already in the series earlier. So I'm going to be a little repetitive. I'm going to give you that upfront, that there is going to be a little bit of repetition, but consider this as mananam. Consider this as something that we have to keep repeating to ourselves, because our minds have been conditioned with samsara over many, many, many lifetimes. And unless we repeat this over and over to ourselves, either through the process of manana, which is we talking to ourselves, or through the process of shravana, either we reading or listening from others. So I invite you to do that. And that is my excuse for being repetitive, right? And I think that's a valid excuse too. So we'll listen to the next shloka, shloka number 25. And we will again go into those aspects of a spiritual life that distinguish it from a worldly life. So this is shloka number 95, shloka number 25 of the 9th chapter. We'll listen to it in the voice of Brother Shyam, our volunteer who has been kind enough to do all the recordings for us, who has so very clearly and articulately, beautifully chanted all of these shlokas. We'll listen to it in his voice. I'll give you a very brief meaning of that. And then we will discuss in detail what Krishna conveys there.
Yanti devavrata devan pitrun yanti pitruvrata bhutani yanti bhutejya yanti madhyajinopi mam.
Votaries of the gods reach the gods. The votaries of the mains go to the mains. The worshippers of beings reach the beings, and those who worship me reach me. That's the 25th verse of the 9th chapter. In this shloka, Krishna states something that, as I just said, has spoken about in length earlier also. He had said, if you think of the Lord in the last moments, you reach the Lord. If you think of other things, you reach them in your next life. And in that context, he made one point very clear. What you have obsessed with throughout your life is what you will think of in the last moments of your life. Only if you have worshipped the Lord through your life, you are likely to think of him in the end. And when you think of him in the end, it is to the Lord that you go. So he repeats something that is very similar here, but in the context of worship, in the context of performing a certain kind of a puja or a worship or a aradhana to the Lord. Having said that, all worship reaches me, right? That's the statement that he made very, very clearly. He said, aham hi sarva yajnanam bhokta. Yajna here stands for all worship. So, sarva yajnanam bhokta cha prabhureva cha. I am also the one who is the master, the prabhu. So, having said that, why is it important to worship? Knowing this consciously, that all worship only reaches him, right? Whether I realize it or not, all worship reaches him. So if I'm going to sit in front of any deity, go to any temple, do any kind of puja, it is going to reach him. But there is a difference in doing it consciously. That's what it appears to be. Krishna says in this shloka, Deva Vrataha, the worshippers of the gods, Yanti, go to Devan, to the gods. We spoke of how many of these pujas and worships are offered to different devas, right? When you talk of yajnas and yagas, they are addressed to many devas and many devatas like that. And we have no scarcity of devatas in the Sanatana Dharma, right? Because Swami would say as many people are there, that many deities are there. Because every person has a different approach to life, and that fashions the divinity that they are approaching, right? So there are any number of devatas. When you look at it from the point of view of scriptures, that mandates so many yagas and yajnas. These are all addressed to different deities, right? And these devas, if you look at them, they rule various aspects of creation, various aspects of our lives. What is it to worship these devas, and why is it different from worshipping the Supreme Lord, even though all worship reaches the same Lord? We will come to that after we see these different other possibilities that Krishna is speaking about. Possibility one, Devavrataha Yanti Devan. The worshippers of gods reach the gods. Pitruvrataha, the worshippers of the Pitrus or the ancestors, Pitrun Yanti, go to the Pitrus or the Lokas of the Pitrus. There is a Pitru Loka where it is something very similar to the concept of heaven. After having lived, our ancestors or what are referred to as mains go to this Pitru Loka, and that's why when you do all these Pitru Pujas in the Bharatiya tradition, there is this concept of worshipping the ancestors by doing various ceremonies. The ceremonies are generically called Pitru Pujas or Shraddha ceremonies. And sometimes these are done annually. These are done on specific festival days, some sacred days. Or if you are going to a specific pilgrimage center, you're expected to do it in such places. These are all part of the Indian culture. So is Krishna telling us that if you do these ceremonies regularly, there is a likelihood of you landing up in this Pitru Loka and unfortunately getting stuck there? Is that what Krishna is saying? Well, not exactly. Again, we will come back to that in a bit. He spoke about Devavrataha. He spoke about Pitruvrataha. Now he says, Bhutejaha, the worshippers of Bhutas, Bhutani Yanti, go to the Bhutas. Bhutas in general mean elements, but Bhutas here, what Krishna is referring to, are the deities that are supposed to be the ones who preside over elements, right? The word Bhuta itself means beings. So Bhuta is here referred to some deities or some super beings which are in control or are the presiding deities over these elements. And Adi Shankaracharya in his commentary, he says that these are deities that are in a plane of existence slightly higher than that of humans, but it is slightly lower than that of these devas that we spoke of. So these are people who worship different kinds of beings. There are Vanadevatas, there are Gramadevatas, there are spirits, Yakshas, Kinnaras, so on and so forth. Of course, in these days, we are not very familiar with these traditions. We probably don't think too much about these things. But does that make the shloka irrelevant to us? We will see how even then, even if we do not subscribe to these ideas or we don't obsess ourselves with these concepts, still this shloka has a certain relevance to us in everyday life. Again, we'll come back to that. Finally, Krishna says, Madhyajinaha api, also my worshippers, Madhyajinaha, mam yanti, they reach me. So Krishna clearly states a few important things here. One, though all worship finally reaches him, there is a difference in the worships, whether you're worshipping him directly or you're worshipping these various devatas and bhutas or pitrus. And the second point is, each of our destinies are in our own hands, in our own approach to our life, right? So these are the two points I think is very clear from this shloka. So what makes a person, or what makes one form of worship different from the other? Now, if you were to tell me, I have only Swami's picture in my altar, I don't worship any other god, I only have one picture of Swami, or all photos and pictures in my house are only that of Swami's, does that mean that you are a worshipper of only Swami and you will reach only Swami, not to any other loka? There is a chapter in Swami's Vahini, the Satya Sai Vahini, chapter number 19 to be precise. I've spoken about this chapter even earlier as part of one of the Answering Booth programs, and I think also in other segments I must have made a mention of what Swami says here. This chapter is entitled and revolves around prayer. It's a very profound chapter. And if you have the opportunity, you should go and read it. It's chapter number 19 of the Satya Sai Vahini. The chapter itself is very deep and profound. And I will draw from that what Swami says in that chapter, particularly a little later in the program. But to get a complete picture of what Swami is saying in chapter number 19 of Satya Sai Vahini, you will have to read a few of the preceding chapters. Because it's a very beautiful approach that Sanatan Dharma has been gifting us. And sometimes in our narrow-mindedness and short-sightedness, we don't see the complete picture. To give you a gist of what Swami says there, Swami speaks about the Vedic way of life and the culture of Sanatan Dharma. And finally, it leads up to this chapter number 19, which is on prayer. Of course, after that also Swami continues. Since our topic today is about worship and prayer, I am talking of chapter 19 as the culmination. So Swami speaks about the various ceremonies, why certain practices were followed. For example, so it starts right from, you know, why there was a division in society based on birth. What were different types of karmas and so on, the Varna system, so on and so forth. Swami speaks of how all this is based on a much deeper spiritual thought. Today we might look at something like the Varna system, the caste system, and say, just because one is born in a certain family, how can he or she be discriminated against? And that seems like a very valid question. But what have we been seeing in the Gita, at least in the Gita series as we've been going through it? Your birth is not random, right? That's what we've learned from chapter 7 of the Gita. What you have been thinking of all through your life is what you'll think of in the end of your life, and that is what will define your destiny. And then when he was talking about yoga bhrashtas, Swami again made that point. You will be born in a rich family. You will be born in a family of yogis. So that birth is not random. Where you are born, to whom you are born, is not random. Right? There is a quote that Swami makes. This is from one of the shastras, and Swami quotes this in the Satisai Vahini in one of the preceding chapters. Swami says, Yad dhyati tat icchati. That on which attention rests, that is the thing that is wished for. Yad icchati tad karoti. That on which the wish rests, that on which you have desired, that is the thing for which deeds are going to be done. Yat karoti tat bhavati. That for which karmas are done, that is what one becomes in the future. So birth is not random. Your past cravings and adventures have precisely brought you to the birth you are in. Having acknowledged that, having accepted that, if you work on it, you can progress higher, right? That's the whole message of the Karma Kanda of the Vedas. So in that context, Sanatana Dharma says that each section of society is governed by some very specific rules, some mandates of what rituals have to be performed. There are some, as we have come across many times, Nitya Karma, Naimittika Karma, and Kamya Karma, and so many other rituals. And these are all mandates. When a child is born, what you should do. When a marriage happens, what you should do. When there is a death, what you should do. If you're a Brahmin, what you should do. If you're a Kshatriya, what you should do. Right? So these are all given so that you acknowledge where you are born and you work from that point to progress higher in life. Whatever was mentioned in this particular shloka that we just heard, shloka number 25, are all such Vedic rituals. For example, worshipping some devatas through yajnas, performing pujas to certain bhutas, ceremonies for ancestors, worshipping the sun three times a day, these are all prescribed in the Vedas. If worshipping these lesser beings is going to take me to them and not the ultimate goal of life, why are they prescribed in the Vedas? Right? Because here Krishna is saying that if you worship the Pitrus, you're going to land up there. If you're going to worship the Devas, you're going to land up with them. Then why are these prescribed? A regular worldly person, a samsari, a person who is in the world, who is caught up in his or her life of family life, professional life, one who is caught in this flux of samsara, worldly life, such a person is only bothered about yoga kshema. As long as I am alive, I want to live a happy, comfortable and successful life. And this involves attaining some ambitions, attaining some needs and desires and cravings, taking care of the needs of those who are related to us, so on and so forth. So every day in life, we are only struggling for this. You and me, right? Whoever is in the world, we all have yoga kshema in our mind, as we discussed last time. And it is nothing but desires. Desires is referred to as yoga kshema. Something I want to attain, something I want to preserve. And this craving or desire or this approach for yoga kshema is what drives our karmas every day invariably. Some activities are pleasant. Some you have to force yourself to do. Right now, even as I'm talking to you, I'm actually doing my profession, right? This is what I'm paid for. I'm doing that. This provides for my yoga kshema. But at the same time, I'm also enjoying what I'm doing, right? So now I'm doing an activity for yoga kshema, which I am enjoying. Tomorrow I might have to go and sit in a government office for which I'm getting some work done, some registration or some government ID card or driver's license. And as a person, I probably might not like that activity. But I do that also for my yogakshema, even though I may not enjoy it as much. So whatever karma we do, whether it's a liked karma, disliked karma, pleasant one, unpleasant one, whatever we do it for yogakshema. And all those who perform wrong karmas, they are also doing it for the same thing. They are also in the quest for yogakshema. Only thing is, they've lost sight of what is right and wrong, and they are trying to attain yogakshema through the wrong means. We have spoken at length about the importance of prayer and the role it has in karma, right? Right in the beginning, when we were talking about karma yoga, we made mention of this. We do karma to attain something, but when we bring in prayer, we are bringing in the acknowledgement that my karma alone is not sufficient to attain what I want. So in that process, in that humility, we begin to dilute the sense of doership, which is the cause of all problem that comes from karma and its consequences. But when we speak of such elaborate rituals, the mandate that you these kind of scriptural injunctions that mandate us to follow some practices on a daily basis and yearly basis. You have to go and do this, and every day you have to do this. And if you're born in this family, you have to do this yajna at this particular festival. Apart from the fact that they are diluting our doership like any other prayer does, these have another effect on the mind, and that is they discipline the mind. Swami says in the Satya Sai Vahini in chapter 16, he says, and I quote, "In the Hindu religion, rituals and ceremonies were laid down to be observed from sunrise to nightfall without intermission. Many of them are elaborate yajnas and yagas and sacrificial offerings to divine powers, appropriate to the baby growing in the womb until its death and the subsequent attainment of higher worlds. But these rituals and dedicatory ceremonies were not enough, and elaborate disciplines of living were also laid down. No other religion has so many and so elaborate rituals of living. In order to carry out this heavy schedule of rituals or actions, one must have devotion, spiritual wisdom, and self-control. Bhakti, jnana, and yoga. Dharma is the taproot of the great tree of religion. It is the eternal source of its strength. It is fed by waters of devotion. The leaves and flowers are renunciation and other virtues, and the fruit is understanding, or jnana." End of quote. As we have been seeing from the beginning of the Gita, the basis of karma yoga is dharma. And dharma includes moral life, right? Moral living. When a samsari, a worldly person, becomes a worshipper, an upasaka — upasana is worship, upasaka is a worshipper. I'm saying this because I'm going to be using these two words multiple times in the next few minutes. So when a samsari becomes a upasaka, he or she continues to be a person who is still obsessed with yogakshema, but now the person acknowledges God and prayer and worship to be means to attain that yogakshema, or simply improve the chances of that person getting that yogakshema that they want. There is an exam, you study very hard for that exam, you stay overnight and you study, but just before going for the exam, you quickly go and break a coconut for Ganesha and then go. Just to increase the chances of you doing well, right? You do not completely depend only on that breaking of the coconut. You do your studies, you want to clear the exam, so you study hard, but just before that, just to ensure that your efforts are giving you the results that you want. So your karma, the puja that you have done, becomes like a little extra karma that you do, right? In complete contrast, what Krishna said in the 22nd verse is about one for whom this devotion is the foundation. Someone who has completely surrendered. Her or his dependence on God is complete. That's why the word ananya, there is no other. Such a person's yogakshema will be completely taken up by Krishna. Now what happens to the karma of such a person? Now the person will do his or her duty as a form of worship, isn't it? Now I have a family. I work hard to provide for them and keep them happy. I worship God. I do upasana to help me achieve this, to be able to provide for the family and keep them happy. When I surrender to God completely, I am completely aware that He is the one who is going to take care of my yogakshema and the yogakshema of everybody who are around me. But I will not stop doing my duties towards them. Because now my duties, the same duties towards my family, towards my parents, towards my siblings, towards my wife or husband or children, those same duties, I will look at them as my offering to Swami, isn't it? So for a devotee who has surrendered, all karma is only a form of upasana. And this, I think I've repeated any number of times on this series, I know, because this is the bottom line of the Gita. I'll repeat that again. For a devotee or for a samsari, a worldly person, worship is also another form of karma. I do all that I have to do, and just as a little bit of extra, I go and worship God. So worship or upasana is another form of karma. But for a devotee who has surrendered to God, the basis is upasana, the basis is devotion. Now, whatever karma that devotee does towards his family, towards his profession, that karma becomes a form of upasana. Now, what we will do is, let us see how this applies to this particular shloka, where Krishna is speaking about worshipping devas, pitrus and bhutas. When people worship these various beings, the approach is, I have a set of desires and I go to these various beings in order to satisfy these desires or ensure that they do not come and obstruct my pursuit of these desires, right? Both of these prayers are there. We pray that what I am desiring, I should get it, and I am going to do this particular thing. Oh Lord, please don't come in and become an obstacle to this, right? Both these kind of prayers are there. And the way to approach and appease each one of these deities, bhutas, pitrus, is different. The focus is on my desires. The focus is on my yogakshema. So this is a yogakshema-driven approach to life. A desire-driven approach to life. Now for a moment, let us look at this from how we lead our lives. What are these beings or what do they represent? As I said, I mean, if you don't believe in these devatas and bhutas and something and you say, okay, so I don't have to worry about what Krishna is saying in this particular portion, there is a relevance even to our own lives. What are these beings or what do they actually represent? They are entities that are more powerful than I am. And they can influence the outcomes in my life, right? Those are the bhutas and devas that we talk of. I am a farmer. The way the rain god is going to behave is going to affect my life. I am a businessman. I think that Lord or Goddess Lakshmi should be favorably, looking at me so that I can do my business and make money. Or if you go to some of these Indian villages, there will be a Grama Devata, a temple for the village deity, and this temple will invariably be on the outskirts of the village, right? So the deity will be worshipped and propitiated so that no disease or epidemic or pandemic or whatever, or no harm in any form enters the village. she or he will be like the guardian deity of that village. So clearly the approach is one where you are trying to placate someone who is more powerful than you to get your desires fulfilled. As Swami said, when it is worship or ritual, it comes with that added benefit of that process of worship itself will discipline your mind, it will purify your intellect and so on. But if you look at it, don't we do this in everyday life with those individuals who are more powerful or influential in our life? I have a certain set of powers, but then there are some people who are a little more powerful than me. Maybe my superiors in my workplace, or maybe the local politician, or maybe if you're a son or mother, I mean son or daughter in the family, your parents have more power in the house than you. What we were discussing about last week, in the case of surrender, you endeavor only to please one boss is the approach of Ananyas Chintayantuma, right? In everyday life, we try to please whoever has to be pleased to get our works done, right? Be it our parents, be it our superiors, be it our boss, be it our the rulers of the land. And not just superiors or people who have power. We give this power to so many people in our life. We give it to people. We give the power to make us happy and sad. Our peers, our colleagues, our acquaintances. We give them that power and then we try to please them, right? So in that way, if you look at it, this applies to everything. I mean, this applies to everyday life also. It does not necessarily mean only about devatas and bhutas. Now, coming back to the worship of these different deities or doing of these ceremonies, let's focus on that. Just like how a devotee will see all duty as worship, all karma becomes a form of upasana, which means he or she may be serving their parents. But in their mind, the feeling is they are serving Swami. They may be taking care of their children, but in their mind, they are doing a task assigned by Swami. They may even be eating and nourishing the body, but the devotee will think that this is a form of yajna, of taking care of a tool that has been given to them by God, the essence of the Brahmarpanam shloka. A devotee who has surrendered can be defined by these two approaches. One, they do not live a yogakshema-driven life or a desire-driven life. Note my words, they lead a life not driven by desires. I am not saying they are desireless. There are desires, but the desires don't drive their life. They want to please the Lord and they have the confidence in Krishna's promise, yoga kshemam vahamyaham. So they do not have a yoga kshemam driven life. They have a upasana driven life. Yoga kshemam will be taken care of. The second attribute is, whatever they do, their daily karma or duty or their worship to any deity, which is also a form of karma, in their mind, it is directed only to the Supreme Lord because they are not bothered about what will happen to their needs, right? So when I read out that passage, Swami had said that different sections in society have been mandated to do different pujas. Now, as a member of a family, I have certain duties. So now I will look at that worship, that particular yajna or yaga or that particular pitra puja that I'm supposed to do as also one of my duties in that stage in life. And because I do all karma as a form of worship to the same Supreme Lord, I will do even that puja as my offering to Swami, isn't it? So when Krishna says, Yanti madhyajinaha mam, those who worship me come to me, I think he is referring to people with these attributes. Not merely those who say, I have only Krishna statue in my puja room. I do not worship any other deity. Or I listen to only Sai bhajans. You know, I come to pilgrimage only to Puttaparthi. I do not go to any other pilgrimage center. No, that doesn't make you that is not defined by what Krishna is saying here, yanti madhya jinaha mam. Yes, this may be a starting point where there is the faith that all I need is to worship this one God, all prayers are going to be addressed only to Him. But it must graduate to this belief that life itself is a journey towards Him, and this purpose should be what drives my life. Otherwise, we will be a worshipper of these beings that are slightly more powerful than us, and we will only be raised to that level of power, right? Because if I'm praying to a deity, in a way I'm kind of in awe of the power of that deity, and eventually, as Krishna said in the 7th chapter, that is what you'll be in awe of, that is what you will be raised to. And when the merit runs out, you come back to this Mrityu Loka of life, of coming and going. Coming back to that chapter in Satya Sai Vahini on prayer, chapter number 19, Swami makes a very important point there, which is relevant to this discussion. You can clearly see there are two distinct stages in the life of a upasaka. What I already mentioned, when upasana or worship is also part of karma, that is one end of the spectrum, one stage. The second stage, or the other end of the spectrum, is when karma itself is performed as upasana or worship. When upasana is looked at as action, the process becomes very important, isn't it? Any karma, any set of actions, there is a propriety, there is a way in which it has to be done. I want to cook a dish, there are 10 actions that have to be performed. Then there is a certain sequence in which that action has to be performed. There is a certain limitation, discipline related to how much salt you should put, when you should boil, and how much you should boil, and all of that is related, right? Because it is a karma. Karma always has rules, sequences, limitations, and so on and so forth. If I lose my concentration when I'm doing it, the end product will be messed up. So the nitty-gritties and the details become important in karma. So when in this first stage, when upasana is also a karma, the process of that worship becomes very critical. So the details of that rituals will be looked at as being very, very critical. And like any other process, there are some preconditions for the process also. Now if I go to, say, a bank to take a loan, one is my application form which I've filled, that should be correct. Right? That's like the prayer that you're making. The prayer has to be correct. But after that, after you submit your application, they will look at you and they will look at your, say, your credit history, and they'll see whether it is worthwhile to give you that loan. Or let's say they might process it and they might send it to another department which will do that. Or if I'm taking a loan for a business, there may be a separate panel or a committee which will look at my proposal and say that, okay, this is your startup idea. Is it good enough to be to lend money to you? Swami says the same applies to prayer too. And Swami gives a very beautiful example. Swami says there is a king. The king has various ministers who take care of different departments, like there's a revenue department, health departments, and so on and so forth. The king has appointed them. The king has created these departments. He has made this division as to which issue comes under which department. Swami says, though he is the master of the realm, and though he is the creator of the system, he will not overrule the system. If there is an issue, the same master will direct it to the appropriate department to be looked at. So let's say you are a citizen in the country and because of some reason you are not able to pay taxes that year. So you go up to the king and you pray to the king saying that, please, O Lord, excuse me, I'm not able to pay the taxes because, you know, there was a pest problem in my field, or I had this emergency, so many people have fallen sick or whatever. You place that prayer in front of the king. The king will call the officer in charge of, say, the revenue department and will ask him, okay, look into this matter. see if this person has come with a plea like this. You look at that plea and get back to me. Same is the case with how governments run today, right? Now with social media, Twitter especially, many people can directly write a tweet to the minister, the prime minister himself, or say the, you know, the external affairs minister, say that I'm in this situation, I'm caught up here. Then that minister will, you know, probably direct that officer in charge of that particular department to look at it and get back, saying that, you know, look at this issue. Is this person really genuinely having a problem? What kind of a person is he? What kind of an issue is he in? And you get back to me. Even though I have approached, say, the prime minister directly, if the department the prime minister has entrusted with for that particular duty comes back and says, this plea is not genuine, or this person is, you know, doesn't have a good track record and this plea need not be honored, even though the PM is superior to these departments, he will honor those departments, or he will acknowledge the power of those departments, and he will not answer the plea, isn't it? It is not that the PM is powerless. It is not that the king of the realm is less powerful compared to the ministers. But even a king follows the procedures that he himself has set. Because if he doesn't, there will only be anarchy and chaos. Swami goes on to say in that chapter, imagine if a worldly kingdom or a government, in our example, has to be run in that way, how complex will be the working of this cosmos? Swami says, there are different deities for different departments. The divinity concerned with rain is Varuna. Similarly, Surya, sun god, is in charge of health. Ganapati is head of the department that deals with prevention of difficulties that hamper good works and so on. And when you make a prayer, the prerequisite for that prayer to be considered by that deity is whether you have led a good life as mandated by God, as given to us by the scriptures. In simple words, moral life. In other words, the merits earned by leading a good moral life. And that also explains why it appears like God seems to be listening to people who don't have, who in our view, in our judgment, are not good people. That person is such a bad fellow, and he prayed to Swami and Swami answered him. It only means they're using up merits of the past, right? This is something that Swami has said many times. Well, the most important part is of that particular chapter, which I said is relevant to what we are discussing, where in that chapter Swami says, there are some prayers that are not diverted to other departments, that are directly sent to the Supreme Lord and he looks into them. Which means, even if you worship Swami directly, like the example that Swami gave, you can go to the king directly and pray to him, but it will be sent to different departments. Similarly, you may be worshipping Swami directly, but then Swami says your prayer will be sent to that particular department. Fulfillment of this desire, marriage separate department, childbirth separate department, health separate department, Swami says it will be directed to that department and they will look into your track record and dispense the benefit for that prayer. But there are three types of prayers and offerings that Swami says come directly to him and he deals with them. And that is something that as devotees we all are very, very interested in. Swami says those three types of prayers or offerings are Nishkama Karma, activity not prompted by personal desire. Niswartha Prema, activity emanating from unselfish love. Nirmala Hridaya Prarthana, prayer arising from a pure heart. Nishkama Karma, Niswartha Prema, and Nirmala Hridaya Prarthana. And I think we will not be wrong in concluding that these three qualities only define a devotee who worships Krishna, who worships the Supreme Lord, who worships Swami directly. And as devotees, these are the three we must work on. Once these qualities are there, once I am able to do all my actions without any desires, once I am able to have selfless love, not only towards Swami, but towards everyone, and my heart is pure, I might be sitting and performing a Shraddha ceremony for my ancestors, but I will be doing it selflessly, thinking of Swami. And that prayer will reach Swami, and I will not end up with my ancestors. And when that prayer goes to Swami directly, when Krishna said, Yoga Kshemam Vahamyaham, whatever benefits I had to get from my Pitrus, that Swami will ensure it comes to me, isn't it? Whatever benefit I have to get from a specific Devata, I will receive them. Or Swami will probably call that Bhuta or that Devata and say, look at it, this is my devotee, you give him or her what is required at this particular time. Maybe that is the workflow of what Krishna said, Yoga Kshemam Vahamyaham. When Swami had taken some devotees to Badrinath, there is this place on the way to the shrine called Brahma Kapal. And this Brahma Kapal is a place which is very significant to perform these ceremonies for ancestors in that particular place. So when they came across this place, Swami made everyone in that entourage to actually sit down and perform this Pitru Yajna, or that Pinda Pradhanam, what they call as the ceremony that you perform for your ancestors, for your means. Swami made them sit down and perform. Which means, now when you're sitting there and doing the puja, it is an instruction from Swami that you're doing. You might be doing a ceremony, you might be worshipping a deity, you might be worshipping Pitrus, but you are obeying Swami, and that also becomes a part of your worship to Swami, isn't it? So what would be the attitude of those devotees who did it that day? They are only offering it to Swami, isn't it? And as we've been seeing for the past couple of weeks, this ability to focus on God in this manner comes with love and devotion. It cannot be intellectual. This, I feel, is a very simple tip that Swami is giving us directly to achieve that state of Ananya Chintana. Try and do all actions without craving for the fruits. How do you achieve that? Doing actions as worship. The other way is conveyed in the next point. Do whatever you do with selfless love, Niswartha Prema. And the third point, try to keep the heart as pure as possible. Don't have any malice or hatred towards anyone. Don't try to harm others by your deeds. We discussed with what attitude, if offerings are made, it reaches God, right? So till now what we've been speaking is whom to worship, how to worship, right? So then the next question that comes is, now I'm performing a worship, what do I offer to God? What am I going to offer to God? And that is spoken of in the next shloka. Though I'm having very, very less time, I'll probably play out the shloka, we'll listen to it, and we'll discuss as much as we can in the next 5-10 minutes, and we'll conclude with that. Next week, we will take up whatever we are not able to cover in this week for the next shloka.
Patram pushpam phalam toyam yo me bhaktya prayachati tadaham bhaktyupahritam ashnami prayatatmanah.
Whoever offers me with true devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or even some water, I accept this offering made with devotion by him who is pure of heart. That was the 26th verse of the 9th chapter. Again, one very popular shloka from the Gita, and more importantly for us, one that Swami has quoted any number of times in his discourses. After having said how and who should be worshipped in the previous shlokas, Krishna says, what offering should you make? Krishna said, if you worship Pitrus, you will go to them. If you have done these obsequies, you will know. If you're a person who regularly does these, you will know these can be quite expensive affairs. A few years back, I got a question on the Answering Booth program where a devotee had placed this situation. The family had some financial issues. There was no steady flow of income for the family. And this devotee's parents were very traditional. And they insisted that these pujas have to be done year after year for these pitrus and ancestors. And, you know, they would do it year after year without fail. They felt that maybe whatever problems they were undergoing was because their ancestors were unhappy with them. And if they stop it, the ancestors will become more unhappy and they'll go into bigger problems. But then the process of doing these pujas itself was so expensive, and that was also draining their resources, right? And there was a talk I was listening to a few years back given by one of the social workers who works with villagers in North India. And this person was telling how many rural people in North India begin to move to cities, they migrate to cities because of some of these ceremonies. If you live in a village, you live within your community, within those people. There might be 100, few hundred people in a village. They all know each other and you're expected to perform these rituals because these also are a form by which you bond with that particular community. So you are expected to do these rituals, and if you don't do them, you become an outcast. If you keep doing them, you get pushed further into poverty, and coupled with fear and ignorance and superstition, the situation just gets even more worse. So many of these rural people eventually migrate to the cities because of some ceremonies like this, not able to hold on to some of these traditions. And moving to the city, you will at least not be judged by the people around. Similarly, any form of worship, ritualistic worship, has a lot of elaborate procedures and paraphernalia. As we see, as we saw such pujas done by the first level of worshippers, they see their worship as karma. Then the objects involved in the worship, the process involved, everything becomes important. A rich man does a puja, he breaks 108 coconuts. The other people who look at him say that, so this puja has to be done by breaking 108 coconuts, and they go through enormous trouble to ensure that their puja is also as elaborate. Swami gives the example of the cat in the Satyanarayana puja. There is a man who always used to do Satyanarayana puja, and he had a pet cat which used to disturb the puja. Swami would say that, so what he would do is, before he starts the Satyanarayana Vratam, or before that stage where he offers Naivedyam to the Lord, he would first go catch his cat, put it under a basket, and then do this Naivedyam. Years later, his son takes over the tradition from the father, and eventually the cat in the house dies. So when he has to do the Satyanarayana Puja, the son thinks, oh my God, how can I do it? I don't have a cat. Then he goes to the market, purchases a cat, and then performs the Satyanarayana Puja. Because when you look at worship as karma, you don't know which aspect of that puja is critical and which is not. If a novice has been, you give a recipe to a novice like me, I don't know which aspect of that recipe is critical and which is not. So I will stick to the word of that recipe. Same is the case with anybody who is doing worship as a part of karma, right? So you try to be as elaborate as you can. So that makes this process of worship itself so complex. And this whole confusion makes worship literally something that is, something that is not easy to perform. And when something like puja is not easy to perform, it appears that God is not easy to please, isn't it? And what does Krishna say after all this? He says, in the previous shloka, yanti devavrata devan. After doing all these elaborate procedures, yanti devavrata devan, you do this elaborate yajna and finally you end up with the devas. Pitrin Yanti Pitrvitaha. Year after year, you do all these Pitru Pujas with so much difficulty, you spend so much money, so much energy, and then finally you end up with the Pitrus. And those who worship the Bhutas reach the Bhutas. So after all this, you end up with them, and even that briefly, it is not a state of ultimate attainment. After you spend that punya, again you come down. In contrast, Krishna is saying, if you worship me, you will reach me, and there is nothing more to achieve. This is yours to keep forever. When you worship me, you reach me, and there is nothing more to reach. Immediately our mind might think, how much more complex must this worship be? If to please the Pitrus requires so many steps and rituals, and that attainment that comes at the end of it is not so supreme. Here is Krishna saying the attainment is supreme. So how much more complex must be this worship? But what does Krishna say? Patram. Give me a leaf. Pushpam. Give me a flower. Phalam. Give me a fruit. Toyam. Just give me a bit of water. Yome bhaktya yachit. Prayachati, who offers to me these with bhakti, with devotion, tat, that bhakti upahritam, that offering that is made with devotion, prayatatmanaha, of the pure-minded ones, aham ashnami, I accept. Swami had said in the Sita Sai Vahini that we went through, what is offered with Nirmala Hridayam, it comes directly to me. Krishna says, Tadaham Bhakti Upakhritam Ashnami Prayatatmanaha. I accept what is offered by a pure heart with devotion. Offer to me anything, Patram, Pushpam, Phalam, Toyam, a leaf, a flower, a fruit, some water, anything, just offer it with love and I will accept it. There is nothing more to this ceremony of worshipping the Lord. And these are not empty words. Every time an avatar comes where there is an opportunity for us to see what pleases him, right? These are all words we read in the scriptures. But when an avatar comes in a human form, we can literally witness what pleases him. And he has played out the statement of the Gita through the many stories we read in the Bhagavatam, be it the Srimad Bhagavatam or Sai Bhagavatam. Swami would say in his discourses, what did Shabari give? What great fruit that she could have offered to Rama that Rama, the prince of the entire realm, could not have had? Draupadi gave just a small leaf and Krishna was pleased, and he pleased so many others with that. Krishna is telling, offer me a fruit. When Krishna goes to the house of Vidura, Vidura did not even offer a fruit. Vidura threw the banana fruit and offered the peel. And Krishna ate it. And if I start speaking about Swami, I'm going to take the next 1 hour, so I will stop here. We will take up this later. This is the simple description of this shloka. There is also a deeper significance for this shloka too. We will speak of that too. And we'll take up next week's episode starting with this 26th verse. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me again. We'll resume this most beautiful and noble pilgrimage of the Gita series next week at 10 a.m. Till then, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.